today, my guest is Dr. Michelle Potter, who is a leader in the field of dance writing and criticism and was the inaugural curator of dance at the National Library of Australia. And currently she's an independent dance writer, historian and curator, and she has a doctorate in art history and dance history from the ANU. And Michelle is also a recipient of two Australian Dance Awards, Services to Dance in 2003, an outstanding achievement in dance on film in 2001. And so she comes to us with very great credentials. Michelle, lovely to see you again.
Thank you for inviting me, Alex. Great to be here.
And in fact, you were so kind to join me recently talking about the death of Anna Volkova, which was kind of a sweet, bittersweet story, because of course she got to a great age, but you got to interview her.
I did, and it was part of the oral history interviews that I've been doing for the National Library that started actually before I was curator of dance and continued while I was curator of dance, and I've picked them up again now. So Anna Volkova was one of those, and I've done over 100, I suppose, now.
So you love doing it?
Oh, I absolutely love it. It's just such a privilege to talk to these people who are so willing to share their personal stories with you. And, like, it's just a privilege, I guess.
How long do you spend in those interviews?
They vary. Probably the average is about 4-5 hours. Some of them are 1 or 2. Some of them go on for much longer. I know some politicians whom I haven't interviewed have talked for much longer than that.
Why does that not surprise me?
But I've mainly concentrated on dancers and choreographers, but I've also interviewed other people in other areas, the arts. Robin Archer, for example, was one of the early people I interviewed early in my oral history career. And I've interviewed designers and... In a couple of weeks, actually, I'm going to Melbourne to interview a gentleman called Gary Hutchinson, who was one of the initial members of the Australia Council, a Gough Whitlam appointment to the 1973 Council. So that, I hope, will be quite interesting. So it's a very varied thing.
It's fantastic. I might just get you to drag that microphone, because you're an experienced interviewer, you won't mind me. Just drag that closer to you.
Closer
just
to me.
That's great. Thanks, Michelle.
Okay, you like it like this?
Yes, I like it like that.
Good.
Thank you so much. And given we've got a little bit of work going on, apparently a buzzsaw is about to start across in the other studios, it'll be good to have you. And it's a bit daunting then to be interviewing someone who's obviously pretty good at interviewing yourself. Are you finding you're getting better at it?
Oh, yes. When I look back at the very first interview I did, I feel ever so slightly embarrassed, I've got to say. And the first person I chose to interview was actually my former dance teacher, because I thought I'll feel so comfortable with her, and I did. But you do definitely get better. I'm sure you feel the same.
I think I learn something every time I do an interview. Yeah. It's such a skill that you just grows and grows and grows. And I try to listen to other people's interviewing styles as well.
Yeah. Well, I've learnt that it's quite important in an oral history anyway to stay out of the conversation as much as possible, because it's somebody, usually an elderly person, telling their life story, and they really don't want to hear all about you. It's about them. So that's the main thing, I guess, I've learnt from doing oral histories.
Something I could learn a lot from too.
I think you're in a slightly different situation.
It's not really
an oral history.
And the importance of these oral histories, Michelle?
Oh, well, I think they're incredibly important, because, especially in the field of the arts, because there's such a small amount of material that ever gets published about artists or dancers in particular. And often the oral history is the only record we have once they do die, of their careers, and they've made such an amazing contribution to the development of dance and the arts in Australia, and there's nothing about them, but these oral histories are there, and they're usually very frank about what's happened. They like to gossip a bit sometimes, and yeah, I think they're an incredibly invaluable resource. Yeah.
So, and I want to come back, and I know you've got a couple of excerpts and some of the oral interviews that you've done. Michelle Potter is my guest this afternoon. Did you, this whole career, which is just has been fantastic and includes working in many places around the world, did it all start as a little girl who wanted to dance?
Yes, except I wasn't all that little. When I was really little, I loved sport and I wanted to be in the Olympic Games and all this kind of stuff. But I guess it was that physical activity that I loved. And then one day my mum, this is a classic story, one day my mum took me to see a ballet performance and I was gone forever.
And you were done.
Yeah, I was. And I had a friend at school who was learning ballet at that stage, and she used to pass me little notes and there'd be drawings of first position and second position and third position with the feet, and these notes would go back and forwards. And in the end, my mum took me to dance classes, and yes, I haven't done anything else with my life. I mean, apart from, you know, the usual things like get married and have kids. Since it's always been, dance has always been part of my life.
So how old were you?
I was 12 when I first started, which is quite late, because a lot of little girls do start when they're 4 or 5. Yeah, but I was a late starter. Mm. But nevertheless, I
did very well.
Well, what's interesting, I think, too, about dance is that because the body, it's such a physical activity, and the body does tend to give up on you after a while, like sports people, you have to keep trying to reinvent yourself, I think, to stay in the field. And I've, after a kind of performing and doing things like that, I went on to teach. And then when I didn't really want to teach anymore, because again, the body gives up and you can't really show people the way you want to show them what to do, I started writing. So that's how I've progressed through
a lifelong love affair.
Yeah, exactly.
It's beautiful. You've been able to kind of just evolve within the thing that you love most.
It's been a matter of necessity, I think. As I said, to stay in the field, you have to keep changing, reinventing yourself.
And just reading your bio, your professional dance career started with Maurice Sullivan and Mina Shelley.
Yeah, they were quite interesting because they used to run Christmas pantomimes in a department store that used to be called Farmers, which is now Myers in Sydney. I think it might have been even Grace Brothers at one stage. Anyway, it used to be called Farmers when I was there, and they would have Christmas pantomimes every year, and there was always a ballet in it, as there always is in a pantomime. And they were those old-fashioned pantomimes where there was a dame and, you know,
a baddie.
And a baddie, and the audience would hiss, this kind of thing. And I was in the ballets there. So that was, and it was really quite fabulous because I was being paid. And I was still at school, but I was actually getting paid to have this great time. And we would do 4 shows a day, so it was pretty full-on work, but always no.
And how did you deal with nerves going in front of big crowds?
Well, I don't know. I don't think I was nervous. I mean, sometimes when you're young, you
just doesn't go
matter.
Out there.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I was more worried about the costumes because I remember being in Aladdin and I had 4 different roles in this pantomime, and one was a very quick change into a kind of a tie-looking costume that had about 15 parts to it that you kind of added onto the basic thing, and that was the most nerve-wracking part of it, not the audience.
For 4 performances.
Yes. Anyway, it was a great experience and very good learning.
So that was through your teenage years?
Yeah.
Oh, tremendous. And being paid as well.
Yeah, fantastic, eh?
Dr. Michelle Potter is my guest this afternoon in Canberra Close Up. And Hannah's writing up one of those, oh, no, you didn't, or yes, you did, pamper mine. Look, he's behind you. We know those. And, of course, so many Australian soap actors have gone on to England. England's still big into panto, more so than we are now.
I think it's kind of losing its appeal here anyway. Yeah, but it was a very big part of the 60s, I think, mainly the 60s, the late 60s and into the 70s. And I mean, obviously it started way back before then. But the person who directed these shows was very much into the old-fashioned style, and it really was one of those things where I can't see him, can you? And the audience would, behind you, kind of thing. Anyway, it was great fun. It was absolutely great fun.
Yes, I'd have to say, whenever I have sat in those audiences, I've loved every minute of it.
Yeah, no, they're great.
Perhaps we shouldn't be so serious. Michelle Potter is with me. Michelle, let's go to some of your music now, because I want to talk about how you came to Canberra and then your studies. But tell me, what would you like me to play now?
What would I like you to play? We've got Ivor Davies and the Iron Dice House cover.
Have you chosen this?
Well, I've chosen that because during the 1990s, I used to write a lot for Dance Australia, the industry magazine, and I used to review and write feature stories. And foolishly, I asked if I could review a lot of Sydney shows, and I was living in Canberra. So I would drive up to Sydney, review the show, go to the show, and drive back all in the one, you know, moment of time, as it were. And I can remember driving home constantly at about 1 a.m. in the morning, singing along to
keep you awake.
Yeah, to keep me awake, probably. But it comes from a wonderful set of covers that Graham Murphy used for a ballet that he did called Berlin. And I'd always have great admiration for Graham and Janet Vernon. And this reminds me of that whole experience, I suppose.
Song and reminding you of the drive and Sydney.
And Sydney Dance Company. Yeah, yes.
And the Graham Murphy.
And the whole Graham Murphy experience. And of course, now Raphael Bonicella's got that company and they're coming to Canberra, opening tomorrow night, I believe, with Project Rameau.
Yes, and they're celebrating their 45th anniversary.
They are.
To follow someone like Graham Murphy into a job like that must have been one of the more daunting tasks.
Yes, I think Raphael did understand that it was a difficult job to come into. But he's such an amazingly vibrant person and has his own way of working. And while he acknowledged what Graham had brought, he knew he could do something else, and he has. So that's good.
And that's what you've got. That's all you can do,
yep.
Isn't it? Be very clear
right.
about I'm a person in my own right, but I guess you can imagine. My guest this afternoon is Michelle Potter, who is a freelance these days writer on dance writing and criticism, and independent dance writer, historian and curator. And just a text message from Michael from Braddon about the oral history is saying, could you ask Michelle if she ever did an oral history with Madame Zora Zemberova? I was a student, not very good of hers, at Flinders Uni, and I'd like to hear if she did.
Oh, well, I didn't, but there is an oral history with her that was done only, I'm not quite sure of the exact date, but it was not too far. She was fairly elderly, but not too many years ago. I can't remember even when she died, but it was maybe 2011 that she died. So it may have been done in 2009 or 10.
So it would be there in the National Library.
Yeah, it's there in the library, yes. So Michael may like to go to the library and ask
spend
if
a
he
few
can
hours
access it.
Yes. With your old teacher.
Yes, I'm sure he would find it very moving.
I suppose the whole story of coming to Canberra, you went to Sydney University, you studied social anthropology and did a dip ed. Was that kind of your parents saying, back yourself up with...
Yeah, you need to have a proper job. No, they weren't like that at all, but it is very difficult to make money, especially in dance in the late 1960s. So I did. I did a dip ed, and I actually taught foreign languages for a little while in Sydney and then got married and we moved to Canberra. My husband joined as what was called in those days a graduate clerk in the public service. So, and we've been in Canberra ever since. That was, I think we came in about 1970, or it could have been 71, but so we've been here a long time.
What did you think when he got the posting to Canberra, though? Was it a...
Oh, it was an adventure.
Okay.
Yeah, it was an adventure. I hadn't heard of Canberra bashing until I got here, basically. So it didn't worry me at all. And the money was good for my husband, so, yes, we came.
And which foreign languages did you teach?
French and Indonesian.
Oh, do you still speak them?
I still speak French reasonably well because we go there quite often. Indonesian I'm not so good at anymore. I can go into the market and say, is that a chook's egg or something like that, but nothing very philosophical.
For that longer conversation. And I suppose there's that big push, isn't it? That
there is now. And that's quite interesting because my husband and I think back and or look at this current Asia push and think to ourselves, well, it was going on all those years ago as well, because I met him while we were both studying Indonesian and Malayan studies at Sydney University. So there certainly was a big push then.
So it's not just but the take-up's obviously not huge.
No, it isn't. Although I had extremely enthusiastic students in Indonesian. They absolutely adored learning it, and they liked knowing about... And I'm going to Bali and places like that wasn't a big thing at that stage either. So it was very exotic to them, and they loved the folk songs. One of my favourite stories about teaching is on a Friday afternoon, I managed to have my Indonesian class not hear the going home bell because they were all so busy singing Indonesian folk songs. And one of them looked out the window and all these people were kind of leaving. And they thought, what?
So I bet all the other teachers going, oh, she's good.
Yeah. Well, like I said, it was a very interesting language and quite an interesting culture to teach. So I think that's how it happened, basically.
And so with the move to Canberra, you then worked as a dancer and a choreographer, is that?
Yes, because Brian Lawrence and Janet Caron, who both were principal dancers with the Australian Ballet, had started up a school here in Canberra, and it was first known as the Brian Lawrence School of Ballet and then National Capital Ballet School. And I was still very much wanting to keep up taking classes, so I went to take classes with them and they asked me to teach for them. And I taught for them for a long time, over 10 years, I suppose, and did some choreography for them and for what used to be called Canberra Opera. I don't think it exists anymore. But yes, I was teaching then and doing a bit
of... Will people remember some of the shows?
I'm not sure I can remember, to tell the truth. No, they probably would if I could.
But what was the whole scene like in Canberra here, the dance scene? What?
Round about that same time, Canberra got a permanent professional dance company that was led by Don Asker and was called Human Veins Dance Theatre. So it started to get quite a good dance feel to it, I think. I'm not sure when Don came. It was toward the late 1970s sometime, probably the late 1970s. And he ran a very interesting contemporary dance company for a number of years. So, and there was Canberra Opera too. They used to have dance in their performances as well. But it was not long after that that Merrill Tankard came. And I think that, for me, started something really quite vibrant in Canberra, because I've always thought that the arts attracts the arts, as it were, so dance attracts dance. And after Don and then with Merrill, I think Canberra started to get a really nice dance feel to it. And Merrill always used to say when she was working in Canberra, she always thought of the city as being very suitable for festival, a dance festival, and it was halfway between Sydney and Melbourne, etc., etc. But it didn't ever happen, but it was a lovely, vibrant era, I think.
Maybe it could still happen.
I'd love it too.
The influence of Merrill Tankard, and I know you've done work with her, haven't you?
I've written an unauthorised biography of her.
How important is she?
I think she's been a little bit forgotten now, to tell the truth, but I think she changed the face of contemporary dance in Australia, and she brought, especially in Canberra, and she brought a very strong European influence, because she'd spent so much time working in Europe with Pina Bausch. She brought that whole German expressionist style of dance to Canberra, so to me she was very important for that. But I think she had this wonderful larrikin quality about her. She was, and still is, incredibly Australian, and still would love to work in Australia, but doesn't get any gigs anymore, unfortunately. So she seemed to be able to combine that European expressionist style with her own Australian-ness, I suppose, I thought was lovely.
And what does it say about Australia that she doesn't get any gigs here anymore?
We should go into that. It is a shame, I think, that people get so easily forgotten. Merrill had a bad time too, and
was she ahead of her time?
I tried to cover it in my unauthorised biography. And she's an artist who wanted to do it her way and is a very uncompromising person. And it was always very hard for boards and for people who had to get the people into the auditorium, etc., to handle the way she worked. But by the same token, you got amazing work from her. So it's a balancing act. Merrill's a bit of a balancing act.
Has your unauthorised biography been published?
I published it myself. And there's a story about that too, because I did actually find a publisher for it. But Merrill, in her wonderful, unique manner, declined to give me permission to use certain extracts from oral histories. They were actually, and they were, and she decided, I'm trying to find the best way to say this, she declined to support the book, and the publisher then thought, well, you know, there's going to be a great brouhaha and a scandal, so dropped out. So I thought, well, I've done 10 years research on this and I'm not having it sitting in a box under my bed, so I published it myself. So
is it still available?
It's available from me, yes.
I'm going to line up for a copy. And Michelle, you're saying that your next choice of music would go perfectly after that conversation. Tell me.
Yes, because it's very hard to pronounce. Ovdovyala Lishikata. And apologies to Mara Keek for this, but it's one of the pieces of music that Meryl used in her work Songs with Mara, and the music was from Mara and Lou Keek. And Meryl taught her dancers the style of singing that Mara uses, which is a Bulgarian style of open throat singing. And this is one of the pieces of music from that work.
Ultimately exotic, isn't it? Does that sound?
Absolutely incredible. And Meryl always used to say that everyone can sing, although I'm not sure that people have heard me yet. And it was just a matter of training the voice, and she had Mara teach her dancers to sing, and always used to say, it's just like dancing with these amazing things that are inside your throat. And, I mean, the dancers were wonderful.
Michelle Potter is my guest this afternoon in Canberra Close-Up. Just on dance, and a lot of people go, oh, I just don't get it. I don't get that ballet stuff. What do you say?
You don't have to get it. I mean, seriously, you don't have to understand everything to go along and feel the joy and the passion and the drama and whatever happens to be within that physical movement. And there's never any set meaning behind a dance work anyway. You make up your own. And, you know, I wrote my PhD thesis on Merce Cunningham and the designs that Robert Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns made for him. And, of course, one of his great collaborators was John Cage. And between John Cage and Merce and Rauschenberg in particular, they had this great theory that has been picked up by all kinds of other people since and probably before as well, that there's no set meaning. It's what the audience makes of it. So that's what I say to people. You go along, you don't have to have the same interpretation of it as the person next to you.
And a lot of people are then frustrated with that because
they probably are, but then that
it's generates too postmodern or
that generates arguments, and I love having those kind of arguments about what it means. And in fact, I saw not so long ago this thing called In the Mind of Igor or Itmoy or whatever they condense it down into an acronym, however you pronounce it. And my husband and I had this argument for ages about whether it was postmodern and whether Michel Foucault was in it and whether it was about French literary theory. And I was probably about none of those things, but, you know, who cares?
It was time well spent.
Yes, it was. And it was great movement. Those dancers were such fabulous physical movers that you couldn't help but get drawn into it.
And is essentially that's what you love about it? Is it... What, if people have said, why have you chosen dance to devote your life to in all the different forms?
Yeah, I suppose it is the physicality and the fact that there's no speaking, so you don't have a text that you can someone can say, well, look, the text says blah, so it must mean such and such. It's capable of so many interpretations and so many ways of looking at it, basically. And I suppose going right back to when we started this interview, I always loved sport when I was a child. And so there's something about its physicality that I find amazing.
And that was the case. Did you go along to the architecture?
Monument. Gary Stewart's monument. I did. And you're right. And that's Gary Stewart, the choreographer. And Raphael Bonicella has the same feel about his Sydney Dance Company work now. It's highly physical. And it's, I mean, Monument, we could talk about Monument for ages because that was a fabulous piece, I think. That sheer physicality was...
I walked in behind Aldo Jurgler.
Did you?
It was such a thrill that night. I walked in behind Aldo Jurgler and I'd interviewed Gary Stewart the day before. Yeah. And the physicality of those dancers.
Yeah.
How you do a dance about architecture, I don't know, but he did it.
But he did it. And also his the visuals were so fabulous too. And it was one of those occasions, I think, where the visuals didn't detract from the dancing. Often when there are very strong projections like that, you look at the projections and not at the dancers, but it was so beautiful.
There was a bit of a battle because you had the CAD, you know, computer animated drawing coming out and the sort of pillars of Parliament House. It was so...
As they were growing.
It was extraordinary. Yeah. And I was making myself sort of dodge between the dancers and go, don't watch the pictures too much, watch the dancers.
Yeah, I thought it worked really well, actually. Collaborative arrangement.
Loved it and wanted to go back again the next night, actually. So.
And unfortunately, the Australian Ballet doesn't seem to be restaging it in their next season in 2014, which I think is a real shame. Other people need to see it, not just Canberra
people.
Because
I just think Canberra won't.
It's Canberra? I don't know. I hope not.
I thought it was an extraordinary work. My guest is Michelle Potter this afternoon. And I suppose I loved when I was reading through your bio and I think I found in part of your reviews and you quoted Ross Stretton and you said, and I'll just read it, dance was not superficial. It's an art form that in its greatest moments engage mind, body and soul.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that was Ross. Ross is... Oh, well, he's an old Canberra boy, I suppose. So it's very nice that you're bringing his little quote up. And it is a beautiful quote and it's absolutely right. Mm.
Well, it made me stop and think about, because a lot of people with the formal ballet will kind of go, I can't get there with the en point, or however you say it. I don't understand all those movements. It's too formal. It's too stiff and structured for me.
Mm. Yeah, well... I mean, it is quite structured because it comes from a very formal heritage, a royal courtly heritage. So it has that very strong structure and formality behind it. And maybe you look on it as those very classical ballets as museum pieces. I don't know. But contemporary ballet doesn't have that same hierarchical structure, really. So it's moved along as well.
Mm. The Gary Stewarts of this world.
Yes.
have taken me. The Pina Bauschers of this
exactly.
world took me.
Exactly. And there's such a great diversity in dance that it's a shame if people focus on one aspect of it and say, I don't like dance because, and they're only really thinking of one genre, I guess, of dance, when really there's so much there to see.
You're on 666. Yeah, someone actually did say that to me today, and I went, didn't you watch Countdown when Madonna first did that dance to Holiday? And we all went, we'd never seen anything like it, you know, back in the 80s, because that's what she was so great at, was dancing.
Yeah.
Is it dancing or dancing?
Oh, I say dancing, but... It's like you say tomato and I say tomato kind of thing.
I've got to swing between the two, yeah. And I've never been quite sure. What would they say? In America, they say dance?
I honestly can't remember to
and
tell the truth.
In England, they say dance?
There, but yeah, probably, probably.
Yeah, tell me about living in New York.
Yes, I lived there from 2006 to 2008, where I had a job at the New York Public Library as curator of the Jerome Robbins Dance Division. And it was the dream job, basically. And I certainly had a great time in terms of what I was able to see and I think what I was able to achieve as well. But I found living in New York very difficult and I just thought, I don't want to live here.
Why?
Well, I found I'd been to New York on two occasions for three-month periods before and I thought, I've lived here for 3 months, I can do this, I can come and live here for a much longer period. But those 3 months, I was on a three-month visa, basically, and I knew I was coming home. I didn't have to have a visa and I didn't have to have one of those things called that you have to get health cards, not health cards, but anyway.
A green card.
No, I didn't have a green card. I had a special visa when I went to live there. Anyway, I didn't have to go through all the bureaucracy of setting myself up there, and it's very depressing. And the health system I found extremely depressing. I won't go into it, but it wasn't a pleasant experience. And I also found that my curatorial expectations of that job were different from the expectations of the people in the New York Public Library. And I think it probably had a lot to do with the fact that they're not government funded and they have to go out and beg for money. I actually spent a lot of my time begging for money from rich donors, some of whom were just amazing people and I loved them, just amazing. But the goalposts always tended to change depending on what, this is my experience anyway, depending on what a particular donor wanted. And I couldn't work like that. There was no such thing as a five-year forward plan. To me, the priorities were all wrong, so it was not the job for me.
Because you had to go around to raise the money?
I didn't mind raising the money, but I minded not having
there was a payoff
the say
in, the,
in yeah. how the money was spent, yeah. And to me, there was a lot of stuff there that I felt was curatorially inefficient. So I, you know, it's not worth it.
No.
No, it's not. Definitely not worth it.
It could be a dream job on paper.
It's a dream job on paper, and it was a fabulous experience being able to go to the theatre so often and being able to go to the galleries whenever we felt like it and, I don't know, we had a wonderful Christmas in Santa Fe once, which is Georgia O'Keeffe territory, so that was amazing. And it snowed.
Santa Fe.
So, yeah, there was some amazing experiences. And one of the donors I met was making a film about a young Cambodian dancer that she discovered while on a trip with the Historic Monuments Society or some group like that, and brought him over to New York and had him trained at the School of American Ballet. And she was making a film about this, and I used to go every weekend up to her estate in Connecticut and work on this film with her. And it was, you know, there were some just amazing experiences. So it's a shame the job didn't live up to all the other good bits.
Michelle Potter is with me. Just because I don't want to miss out playing just back to all the oral histories that the interviews you're conducting and recording for the National Library. You're also doing work with the National Film and Sound Archive as well. But you've sent me two snippets. Tell me about these two snippets and let's play them.
Well, I mentioned before that I've always loved interviewing the old Russian dancers. And one I gave you is Kira Buslov, who, like Anna Volkova, fled from Russia during the revolution and learnt to dance in Paris with the ex-imperial Russian ballet dancers, then came to Australia with the Ballet Russe. It's the same story. But she went on and started up West Australian Ballet in Perth. And lived in Australia for the rest of her life, actually. And I don't know, she was an amazing person. And there's a beautiful clip where she talks about whether she would like to change the life that she's had or not. And you'll hear what she says if you play the little clip.
Everything about my life, I mean, if tomorrow I am dead and I stand in front of the doors of the angel or whoever is there to let me in to paradise or send me down to hell, asking me if I want to go back to this earth and live a life again, which sort of life I would like to live, who will I like to be, I would say to live exactly what I live now, this life, from beginning to the end.
Rather moving, isn't it?
It is. It's very moving.
It's the definition of happiness, in a way.
And, you know, I love listening to... I mean, one of the beautiful things about oral history is that the voice, you hear the voice of the person. And I've often played little clips in presentations I've given, and people will come up and say, oh, that was so wonderful to hear so-and-so's voice again. I'd forgotten what he or she sounded like. So... it really is nice. And those old Russian voices, they're just beautiful.
Who cannot love an accent like that? And you've just got another little one.
I've got Christian Fredrickson too, who was a designer and designed many works for Sydney Dance Company and the Australian Ballet and the Australian Opera and Sydney Theatre Company and Melbourne Theatre Company, and just has been an amazing designer. And what I like about this clip, he's talking about when he came to Sydney from New Zealand, where he was born, and he came to try and set up a new life, and of course he felt there were more opportunities for him in Australia. And he just has such a visual imagination, and you can just hear the way he's describing arriving in Sydney, that he visualises things.
And then I arrived here, and I remember the first night I arrived, I walked down Potts Point, that's where I was staying, and the heat was like, in the old measure, about over 100 degrees. And it was night, and all I can suddenly remember, I was standing along this footpath, sweating, carrying a heavy suitcase, and I became aware in the blackness of a kind of fluttering that caught my eye. And I looked up, and there were all these wrought iron balconies, and on them were sit people sitting, and they were fanning themselves. To me, that was like I died and gone into some totally exotic and strange world.
A hot night.
Yes, it was a hot night, but you can... Yeah. Don't you think you can hear that beautiful. He has such a visual sensibility, I suppose?
Mm. Well, straight away you get the wrought iron balconies,
don't you? Yes, and the fluttering, yes.
Beautiful. Mm. Michelle Potter is my guest this afternoon in Canberra Close Up. We've got a text, Michelle, on the pronunciation. It's dancing with a short A like apple, but you go to a dance like R.
Oh, really? Oh, well, I must take that up.
Thank you, whoever texted that.
I like it. That's
good. I've always sort of hovered between the two, never quite sure. Who do you think, well, just on the international, where is the world's leading centre of dance these days?
Oh.
Dance these days.
I think it's, well, in terms of ballet, it's Paris. And the Paris Opera Ballet, to me, is the most amazing company that I've ever seen. And what I really love about them, apart from the fact that they are technically so amazing, is that they invite choreographers outside the ballet world to make works for them as well. So they've had Pina Bausch actually come in and make something for them. And they've had Tricia Brown and they've had Merce Cunningham, the American modern people. Mm. And the dancers can accommodate They're all kinds of styles. And it's very interesting that since we were talking about oral history, I've been doing some interviews for the National Film and Sound Archives Heath Ledger Project, which is a project that aims, funded by the Ledger family, that aims to record emerging artists very early on in their career. And then we'll go back to them and see how their career has progressed in 5 years and then another 5 years. And one of the young dancers that I interviewed was Hannah O'Neill, who was a graduate of the Australian Ballet School and decided she, the only company she wanted to dance with was the Paris Opera Ballet. And you know what? She managed to get herself a contract there. And that, because the Paris Opera Ballet is such a hierarchical organisation, going back to hierarchies again, it's extremely difficult for even French dancers to join the company. But for dancers outside of France, it's almost impossible. Hannah managed to do it, and she's now got a lifetime contract. And
how did she do it? Just determination?
Just determination. And of course, being good. Yes, and having the
speaking
talent.
French, I assume,
well,
too.
She's part Japanese, okay. So she speaks Japanese and English fluently, but actually went to Paris to take up their offer, which was not a permanent contract initially. It was just a seasonal contract, speaking no French, but now she can speak fluently. So anyway,
you can put her up as the ultimate story of someone who wanted something, yeah. Went for it.
Yep, exactly.
So is that, so, you made a reference before, oh, we go to France quite often. Is that part of the reason you go, is to go to?
I always go and see the Paris Opera Ballet when I'm there, but I guess I love going to France. But I interviewed Hannah in Paris, and just, anyway, to get back to your question, I think the centre of the ballet world is Paris, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And who do you think's made the greatest contribution to dance in Australia?
Oh,
you can name
that's a
many
hard
people.
One, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, that is very hard.
But you'd know better than anyone.
Yeah. I don't know. When you look back at the directors of the Australian Ballet, for example, I loved what Ross did, even though he wasn't very popular, because he did have that mind-body-soul. And he had another thing called the CEP factor, what critics call the CEP factor, which was creativity, energy and passion. And I think he did bring some amazing work into the company. I've always admired Merrill, as you know, and I think Graham Murphy and Janet Vernon have given a huge amount to Australian dance as well. I mean, there are many other people, and your listeners will probably be saying, well, what about so-and-so? But sorry,
I put you on the spot.
Yeah, you did put me on the spot.
I put Michelle on the spot.
And I said Ross, Merrill and Graham and Janet.
I saw the film on Tanya Liedtke not so long ago. She was obviously such a huge loss, of course, out running one morning with her headphones on.
That happened while I was in New York, actually, and on the my staff came up to me and said, oh, did you hear? And even they were shocked that how it happened. And, yes, it's a great loss.
You could see she was going to have a big impact.
I think she was.
Terrible. I now cite that to all young people who walk along the street with their head, because she was killed by a garbage truck, wasn't she?
It was a garbage truck, as far as I know, yes.
Early morning, she was out running, which she'd do, and put music up loud and was accidentally killed. Michelle, look, I've only just scraped the surface of all you do, and you're continuing to work with the National Library, National Film and Sound Archive, writing reviews
for the Canberra Times. Yeah. Yes, and
got another book in you.
Oh, after 10 years with Merrill and the outcome, I think I'm not sure I want to do it again.
You never say never.
No, there's probably something there.
And we go out with Ashley Davis. Will we tell me about this?
Ashley Davis is a native of Kansas with a Celtic background, and I met her in New York. I worked with her mother, who was the head of the performing arts collection at the New York Public Library, and I love listening to Ashley's songs because they make me feel very nostalgic. And I guess it's nostalgic for New York, even though I have said that it was not the place I wanted to work. It still is an amazing place, and Ashley's songs always take me back.
If you're waking, call me early, my dear. For I would see the sun arise upon the new year. Good times and rare times, they all fade the same. How gentle are the memories that carry me away. Fare thee well, my friend. We'll meet again when the moon climbs over the trees. Fare thee well, my friend. We'll meet again on the road just beyond the sea.
Called Ashley Davis, the choice of my guest in camera close-up today, Dr. Michelle Potter, freelance dance writer, oral historian and researcher.